Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. 50 years ago, English rock band Pink Floyd released The Dark Side of the Moon. It sold about 45 million copies and spent an eye-popping 974 total weeks on the Billboard album charts. Put it this way, the album's success was old enough to legally vote. John Kruth is the author of Lunacy, the curious phenomenon of Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, 50 years on. John is also a former Milwaukeean and a musician. He's known for his banshee mandolin playing. Hey, here's an idea. We should try listening to one of John's banshee mandolin albums while watching the movie The Banshees of Inisherin, with the sound off. Perhaps the pairing would blow our minds with intriguing moments of synchronicity. Or perhaps not. But I digress. Beta's resident musicologist Steve Gotcher talked to John Kruth to shed some light on the mega hit that is The Dark Side of the Moon. He finds out that it wouldn't have ever happened if not for founding member Syd Barrett's love of the blues.
I think that, of course, Pink Floyd came out of the whole blues scene that was going on in London. After all, the name Pink Floyd comes from Syd's cats. He named two cats, Pink and after Pink Anderson and Floyd after Floyd Council, two Piedmont blues guitarists from South Carolina. And these guys were, well, at least Syd was a full-blown blues freak. And that's what was happening in London at the time when they were first coming up. And it was also accessible music. It was something that you could be passionate about, something that you could learn how to play. And as we saw, the blues exploded into you don't have the psychedelic scene without learning your blues first. It was just something that kind of organically grew, but also a lot of people didn't realize what they were doing to themselves. These were what David Amram refers to as pioneers, because remember, pioneers get lost in the wilderness and usually have to shoot their horse and eat it.
How much of Dark Side of the Moon is about Syd?
I think that it was inspired by Syd, it was triggered by Syd. As we all know, Syd is going to walk into the studio when they're making Wish You Were Here, and they're not going to recognize him because he's got a shaved head, and people didn't do that back then in those days, and he was overweight, and he just didn't resemble the Syd Barrett that they recognized and that they remembered. So yes, of course, Syd loomed all over The Dark Side of the Moon. Maybe Syd was the big shadow that creates The Dark Side of the Moon, you know?
Dark Side of the Moon opens with Speak to Me and Breathe. How does this set the stage for what's to come?
In a way, it really fulfills, much like an overture. Again, I just love how all of these elements and aspects work together. That's David Gilmour's voice, which I really like a lot. It's very simple, it's very sensual. What's the first thing on the album?
Breathe in the air.
It's the most elemental aspect of our lives. If we stop breathing, we're not here anymore. There were so many rich aspects to work from. When you start this record, it's like, okay, you're following this mood, you're following this path, and then all of a sudden it's like you're literally pulled down the rabbit hole. It's like, where the hell am I? I'm in another dimension.
I hadn't listened to Dark Side of the Moon in years, and mainly because, you know, I heard it so many times that I just didn't really need to hear it again. But it's like ear candy. It is wholly satisfying, even if you know exactly what's going to happen next.
Classic is classic for a reason. You know, as Meet the Beatles, you know, how many times have we heard some of these albums over and over again? And you might not play them or put them on, but somebody else might put it on and you're going to go, Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, that happens to me every time I hear Pet Sounds, for sure. You know, it just pulls you right in. And I hadn't listened to it in a long time either until I kind of made the wisecrack that opened the door to writing another book, which is like, oh, what's next? Dark Side of the Moon? I mean, I start the book off talking about metal and my cool cousin Debbie, who hit me to so much great music every Thanksgiving. You know, I do that for a reason. We all have these connections. And I think maybe a lot of people can't separate Dark Side of the Moon from their high school days, from their first LSD experience, perhaps, or their first sexual experience. Maybe this was the soundtrack to whatever it was that was going on in this rites of passage.
Well, we have to talk about one of the most compelling performances on the record. The Great Gig in the Sky has an amazing improvised vocal performance by singer Claire Torrey. How did she become involved in the project?
Yeah, well, I mean, she was a session singer around that time, as Liza Strike, who was also on that album. They were experimenting. They were lucky that they picked the right person. I believe she was going to see Chuck Berry the night that they wanted come in. And she was like, Pink Floyd, you know, okay, maybe another time. And eventually she came in. And I do understand what the atmosphere must have been like, because no one gave her much of a compliment and no one gave her very much encouragement. They just kind of brought her in and she started to sing and try to feel her way through it. And she just played with it. And then they were like, no words, you know. I have a feeling that recording with Pink Floyd, from what I understand, could be a pretty cold affair. So she just came in and she went with it. I mean, to me, she's like the controlled Janis Joplin or something. Claire Torrey did was that she just grabbed you right by the, you know, the aorta, man. And she just pulled you with, she didn't need any words or any kind of language in her lungs in order to just get right to it, get to your heart. And really, like, it's quite an experience. And what I love about Pink Floyd is 10 minutes before she walked in the door, they had no idea this was going to happen.
Speaking of well-known classics, Money is probably one of the most played songs from that album. But it's kind of unique single because it's got the different time signatures. What can you tell me about the construction of that song?
I love the different rhythms of that song. You know, I mean, odd rhythms are usually associated with like Arabic music. I talked to a number of different bass players in there that you noticed. I mean, there's a strong Wisconsin connection to this book. I don't know if you noticed.
Oh, yeah.
A number of guys and bass players from Wisconsin. John Frankovic from Plastic Land and Brian Ritchie from Violent Femmes are in there. Victor Krumenacher from Camper Van Beethoven out in San Francisco. And most of them are pretty down on Roger as a musician, though he's, you know, obviously a great songwriter. And one has to wonder, I mean, I speculate in the book, was he just sort of messing around with How Many More Times, which was a Willie Dixon bass line that Led Zeppelin copped? Boom, beep, boom, ba, boom, beep, boom, ba.
Money.
And I kind of made a mistake. I mean, how many great songs are written because of mistakes? You know, because it almost has a very similar syncopation as How Many More Times, and yet there's an extra beat in there. And then what they do in the middle of that song, which is brilliant, was, and Dick Parry, again, another Wisconsin connection, because he played sax with the Violent Femmes. Dick Parry, who blows the great saxophone solo, one of the most famous saxophone solos in rock and roll, along with, like, you know, Charlie Brown, He's a Clown, and Respect with King Curtis. I mean, if you think about the most famous sax solos in rock and roll, that's one of them. Dick Parry in the middle of Money. I think it was Parry that was like, hey, just give me a 4-4 and let me blow. Forget this odd time signature stuff. So here they are, giving you this kind of slightly off-kilter, odd rhythm signature that's kind of hard to dance to, and man, wham, they just, again, another excellent example of Pink Floyd dynamics, where they open the door in the middle of that song and the sax just riffs, and so does the guitar.
On the record, there's a lot of different spoken word parts.
I certainly was in the right.
I was definitely, I guess it was cruising for bruising.
It's an interesting story about how that came about. Can you tell us about that?
I'm pretty darn sure this is Roger's idea here. You know, they just walked around and they had index cards, and they invited different people who worked at Abbey Road into the studio, including like Paul McCartney and Linda. Paul and Linda were recording Red Rose Speedway right next door at the same time. The doorman is involved, all kinds of people that were around at the time. Roger just had index cards and asked them questions and, you know, chopped it up and threw it in, and it was really effective. I mean, the first few times you heard it, it was like, what's happening here?
Even though there is a lot going on musically, there's a sense of spaciousness, especially in the song Us and Them.
Us.
How did they accomplish such lush spaciousness?
Space in music, really, it allows it to breathe. And one thing that Pink Floyd had, their dynamics, they understood the use of dynamics better than just about any other pop band out there, except for maybe King Crimson, too.
Mm-hmm. Now, the overall theme of the album is pretty dark, with its depiction of madness and fear and death. Why do you think those themes resonate so well with so many people?
I see that record as a funhouse ride, a spook house. Here's all these things. Here's all these, you know, he's addressing death. He's addressing madness. I think that Roger Waters had, perhaps it was convenient for him to use Sid as a mascot of the insane and supernatural and all of that. You know, it was convenient. So to me, this album is a spook house. It's like, and who doesn't like a scary movie? As long as we all get out the door in one piece and feeling like, okay, we've been through something cathartic. You felt like you went through something. You've had some kind of growth. This album represents a door in that way.
The album closes with Brain Damage and Eclipse. What kind of message are we to take from that ending?
Touch, and all that you see, all that you taste, all
I really believe that he was telling us to follow the light at that point, no matter what you face, no matter how dark it gets, no matter how disoriented you become, follow the light. I really believe that was the beauty of this. And for me, that was one of the reasons why I could write this book, is that I felt that no matter what dark corner you wound up in, you still follow that path. And when you're done and when it's over, you're kind of like, you know, it's just the big.
Let me ask you this. What is the contribution of Dark Side of the Moon to the history of rock music?
Well, there's so many levels. How many levels do you want to talk about it on? I mean, when we're talking about the musicality, here is this fantastic gumbo of influences. Fantastic. I mean, you have jazz, you have classical. So I just think this album to me is very much like the monolith in 2001, right down to the cover, to what it continually represents in the future. It's knowable. You look at it, you think you know what it is, but it continues to reveal itself over time to other generations. And maybe they're understanding and they're looking at it, they're hearing other things that we didn't hear in it.
John Kruth, thanks so much for joining us today. Your book, Lunacy, The Curious Phenomenon of Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, 50 Years On, is a great meditation on that record. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I love that. Put that on Amazon for me.